Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now. Become a snack subscriber and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. And use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more. My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore.
Nobody cares if I'm making a noise.
Yeah, your headset's turned off.
I feel
off,
like
actually.
A fourth wheel in here.
You feel like what?
A fourth wheel.
No.
No, a Josh. A fourth wheel turns a tricycle into
no, Josh,
a wagon.
You're more like a spare. Kind of like riding on the back
the
of a Jeep.
The bald spare.
When Brent falls off, I just slide it in his place.
Man. So we're running. This is like a skeleton crew. The Bear Grease. We got four folks here. Skeleton. We have one of the best
stars.
Mystery guests of all time, though.
Could be on the
Bear Grease Render.
Could
for
be.
Real. So I got Brent here.
Hey, buddy.
I got Josh Lambridge, Spillmaker.
Here,
Who sounds like a
Hold
humpback
a
whale?
It's not me.
Here, turn it.
This way.
You got it. Yeah.
Is that better?
Get it out of your nose.
Say something now.
Something now.
Or give us the snort.
My nose is pretty big.
Pull it out like this.
Right there?
Yeah, that's
snort.
It.
Snort.
This is the first time I've ever done this.
Okay. Let's hear your snort.
These are nice.
You're noisy.
There's no way to get it anywhere. Sorry, Phil. I'm sorry.
You're like a mule.
These I have are like the Britney Spears circa mid 2000s like heads, you know what I mean? Boom,
yeah.
Mike, I like that.
Like
that's very
you
nice.
Garth Brooks.
Yeah, right. So when I'm riding a mule, I have a mechanism that I can use, a physical mechanism I can use to tell how worked up they are, how much physical energy they're exerting, and how close they are to their maximum output.
And my it has Peloton to do with, does the same thing.
It's just like probably a lot like your Peloton. Nostril flare. When you really, I'll look at a mule's nose, and if his nose is just kind of like slightly pulsating, it's like, oh, he's got a lot more. Put the spurs to him. Yep. You know, let's go up the mountain. When they get to just like when the nostrils are flaring out, like getting like a half to three quarters of an inch bigger than usual, and they're moving at like one inflation per second, like
they've maxed out.
Maybe give him a break. Maybe.
You're hitting rev limiter on your mule.
Yeah. That's like pushing it to like 4,500 RPM.
Yeah, right? There you go.
Yeah. So mystery guest we have here today is the crabber himself, Luke McFadden.
He is a crabber.
And I ain't no crabber.
You ain't no crabber.
I ain't no mule skinner.
Well, you're more good, of a mule skinner than I'm a crabber, because you rode a mule right, yesterday right. for probably That's 8 or 9 miles.
Yeah. It was yeah. awesome.
How'd it go?
It was great. No problems at
all. Is
that
your
really.
First time riding a mule?
That was my first time riding any...
Any equine animal?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Well, I watched the video. I thought it was pretty solid.
Yeah. Yeah. He did good.
Yeah.
Were you nervous at all?
Not really, to be honest, because...
That's what made
I don't
him
know
a good
why.
Rider.
I think I'm just maybe I'm a little too dumb to be nervous. It just looked about that situation. It just seemed they seemed nice enough. You know what I mean? I thought,
yeah.
All right, I trust them. I trust
but,
these
you know,
guys.
You get thrown out of a mule. All you got to do is get up and get back on him. You get thrown out of a boat, then you got to swim.
Yeah, it's
hold
a whole
your breath.
Thing. It's
got to hold do a whole lot of
now.
Other
we
stuff.
could get into a debate on the debate on like which one would be worse.
I'm trying to give him his props, man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, true story. I told Luke about a story of a young man that rode with me the other day that had like a zero, like if they're on a scale of 1 to 10 of just knowledge of equine animals, like he would be like -1. And
which end is the
he was
ears
so
old.
He was like, shouldn't his feet be pointed upwards and not right on his belly? He was so. And I'm going to use this word. It's not derogatory towards him, but like almost naive. He just jumped up on that mule and was like so relaxed. And what I was trying to tell Luke is that an animal picks up on the energy. I don't care if you're a neuroscientist and think this earth is just like natural physics. Man, there is something deep going on inside a horsemanship. That's very natural, and there's a scientific explanation for it, but... That animal is picking up what you're putting out. If you're tense, fearful, it feels it. It knows it, and it translates to that animal. If you're just like totally relaxed, because I put this young man on a mule that's usually pretty hopped up, Izzy. And Izzy's a great mule, very much so a finished mule, thousands of miles, never done anything wrong, but she's hard to handle. Like you wouldn't put Meemaw on Izzy.
Right.
Izzy would just, she wouldn't hurt her, but, well, she probably would. She could, because she might. You know, not buck her off, but just kind of get out of control
right,
a little bit.
Right.
And so I put him on there, and I was actually a little nervous about it. But he was a strapping young lad.
Well, and, this is the first I heard of this.
Yeah, I was going to say, you told me this thing was totally fine yesterday.
Well,
it all comes out.
This
now.
Was before that. This was before that. And so I put him on there, and he was so relaxed. Izzy was relaxed, and I mean, he just rode. We rode all over the place, and totally fine. That's what Luke's telling me he did. He was just like, hey, this is no big deal. So
I did notice,
ignorance is bliss when it comes
I
to
I did
mules,
notice
man.
On the yes, video when maybe. They got midstream, there was a little bit of a...
Well, Izzy little, tripped.
Yeah. And Luke's eyes got a little bigger, but
you'll have
you know, that was the only yeah. expression that he had. And he just like, all right, we'll just keep going.
Was that in the when we were crossing the river?
She tripped,
and I thought, oh boy, we got to get our cold plunge in for the day.
Yeah, yeah, that would have been awesome.
Well, hey, before we get to start, I have something for you guys, for each of you.
Ah.
I brought from Maryland. I also smuggled on the airplane. It was not quite as hard as the live crabs, but it was had its own different challenges, but they did make it here.
Okay.
I have one for each of you. And I'll explain after I give it to you. Here you go. Hold on.
Oh, I can't wait. What, Brent, what's your guess?
I don't know.
What
he's
is it?
He's taking off his shoes.
Hold on. Don't show it. Bring it over here, but don't show it to us.
What's my guess it could be?
Crap.
We're even wrapped up here.
Oh, I don't know.
I have no idea. Like, not... Even if, a single idea.
If this is a dead...
Oh, I know what it is. I've felt it now.
If this is a dead fish wrapped up in newspaper, I know I'm a goner.
I know That's what right. it is.
It's All right. heavy. So they're wrapped up in newspaper, but this is a Maryland tablecloth here.
Oh,
that's what we use e-crabs
man.
On.
Oh, dude.
This is unreal.
Oh, snap.
This is a... Tell me what this is.
That's we call that a bluebell or blackhead duck decoy.
Yeah,
you have a canvas back, Brent.
Oh, wow.
Listen, these are not any duck decoys, all right? These are, so you guys just did your book on market hunting deer,
yeah.
right, in America.
Yes.
So the Chesapeake Bay, where I'm from, had a long stretch of history where market hunting ducks was a
Absolutely.
Huge part of culture and, you know,
right.
industry. So these decoys, and that, you know, so that went from 1800 to 18 or 1918 was market hunting when it was legal. And then 1918, they outlawed it. So then there was a culture of outlaw market gunning. So these decoys are actually from between 1918, after 1918, but before 1930. These are actual outlaw market gunning
if
decoys.
If these decoys could talk.
Man, let me tell you, my brother right now, Tim, he's doing a double backflip right now, and he don't know why, because I'm holding this. And to a duck guide, man, this right here is...
It's history, man. And those are made right... You know,
do you think this is hand carved?
Oh, I know they are. I know they are. I could tell you. I have done some research on both of these, and I can tell you who made that one. I don't know who made this one, but that they're from Rock Hall, Maryland, which is right across the bay from me. I crab out of Rock Hall sometimes, and so that the Camsback you have, Brent, is likely turned down on a gun lathe. From like World War One or what? I don't know. Yeah. Not that great. Whatever, like an old military gun lathe that they would these guys would get a hold of.
Right.
So they would turn some decoy bodies. So like that one is likely turned on a lathe and then finished with a spoke.
Do you know
shade.
What kind of wood it would be?
I don't know. They were kind of using whatever.
Yeah.
But that one,
a lot of
was,
them were bass, I think. Basswood.
Yeah, I know that's common these days. I don't couldn't tell you what these are made out
of. It's a heavy wood.
Yeah, so that one that you have is likely hatchet carved and then finished with a draw knife.
Are you
so
serious?
They would take a block and they would carve it with a hatchet.
Wow, it's
and then
beautiful.
They would put it in a vise.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Dude, exactly. You couldn't have given this to people that would appreciate it more.
And that see,
this is going in the museum.
There's a part of me that hates to take history from where it's originated. It's lived its entire life. You know,
within
10 miles of where I live at, you know, forever. And there's a lot of history with these two things, but I know that you guys, if anybody will appreciate it and take care of it, you know, it's going to be you guys. So
this
I don't,
is amazing.
You know,
awesome.
I'm not,
what a gift, dude.
And I have
one more thing for you guys. This is about as good a spot on a gift as could be given.
Oh, I would suggest not eating those paint chips, though.
So this is for you.
A little lead in those paint chips.
Check this out.
So those, I'm sure you know what those are, but those are brass shotgun shells. And so those...
Describe what it looks like, Luke.
It looks like a 12-gauge shell, but it's just made
brass. It looks like a 12. It looks like a spent 12-gauge casing, but it's brass.
Yeah, the whole thing's brass. And so
looks like a section of 1-inch brass pipe.
Those are earlier than the decoys. So those are from... Somewhere between 1900 and 1910, those are from, allegedly, from the guy I got them from and the research I've done. And those were very, very common with the market gunners because they could reload them.
Yeah.
And shells were expensive, so they would use these brass shells that they could.
They used to call them St. Louis twos. They'd shoot number two shot at them when they would head rake them, you know, across the bay. Yeah.
Boy, they used to hunt these things with punt guns, you know. That would really be a cool thing, you know, these like... 10-foot-long shotguns where they would pour like 2 pounds of shot, and then they would use
Check
that little
that out,
sculling
Josh.
Boat and take out the whole flock in a roost.
That man, wow, look at, that's incredible!
You can see the knife cuts on that canvasback's head.
So this is a bluebill. Now bluebill's like a duck that people want to kill up there.
Oh yeah, yeah. Canvasbacks are kind of the king of the Chesapeake.
Okay.
You know, been known for that. But the bluebills, I mean, that's what. You know, that's like number two, really. There's a lot
awesome.
Of them around. So
that is awesome.
It's likely that these have been reheaded since then, but, I mean, they would...
That one's kind of got a cracked head.
You know, they would carve the bodies. They put 20 heads on them in their life because they would just break off.
Yeah.
There's actually even... I was looking them over, and there's a couple spots where there's shot in these decoys,
which I think is cool.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like... And I know they don't look like much, but
there's a shot right under that one's eye. No, dude, that's gonna hang in the museum.
These things have seen things that I hope that we will see again, but it's unlikely, you know.
Wow,
just
cool. Okay,
crazy
hey,
stuff.
Thank you,
I
buddy.
Have a gift for you, and this is not a retaliatory gift. This is not. I was gonna do this before I knew these were here, and in a way, it's a gift from me, Josh, and Brent.
Oh man. These things are getting scarce, man.
Yes.
This is a Genuine, Plot Hound Treed, Ozark Mountain Killed, Custom, One Size Fits All.
Yeah.
Raccoon Hat, made by Josh Lambridge Spillmaker.
Really?
That's a yeah. So my good dog Fern treed that coon.
Really?
And the last guy I gave one to, well, I gave one to Cameron Haynes.
Wow.
And he asked me if I killed it, and I said, probably. Yeah. And the reason it was probably is because there was probably 3 or 4 kids underneath yeah, that tree yeah. that may have shot it.
Right.
But that is a genuine Arkansas
treasure.
Plot Hound Treed
treasure
hat.
Well, thank you so much. That is awesome.
You might need a fur hat up there. It gets pretty cold.
Oh, yeah. No, I might. I think I'm just going to wear it to the airport. Yeah. You know?
Man, hey, if TSA tries to take that from you, call us.
I know.
We're coming to fight.
Right. No doubt.
No, I appreciate that. That is amazing. Thank you so much.
Hey, that's the duck decoys. Incredible. So if you don't know Luke, all you got to do is just look up Luke
Type
McFadden.
L into your search, into your Instagram search.
Just say,
Luke. And he's going to pop
up. Siri goes, Luke McFadden.
Luke Skywalker is second.
Luke Skywalker. Right. Luke. Luka Doncic. He might come up. NBA guy. Scored 60 points.
He ain't no grabber.
Yeah. Nah, so Luke has a big TikTok. You kind of got TikTok was like your thing there for a while.
Yeah. Definitely started on TikTok and it kind of spread across all platforms. Yeah. So now. You know, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube.
Yeah.
That's what I've been putting a lot of time into.
And you're,
here lately.
You're a crabber.
Yeah. Yep. It's what I do. It's a full time grabber.
So. And so you just give me like a short overview of your business. Like you're catching crabs and then you're selling them direct to people.
Yeah. Yep. So I'm 27. I started when I was 18 on my own boat and everything. And I sold to wholesale, you know, middlemen for the first 7 years. And then I tried to get into, you know, retail, which is kind of how I got into the social media stuff. I was trying to figure out, you know, find a market for my product, really. You know what I mean? Just kind of figure out a way to market it better and whatever else. So ended up selling direct to customer. And so I've been doing that for the past 2 years. And it's growing, you know, which is a great problem to have. But yeah, no, I'm a full-time waterman on the bay.
And you tell us about smuggling those live crabs. So like 2 days before he came down here, we're in Arkansas at the global headquarters. I was like, hey, could you bring some crab down here? I mean, if I was going somewhere, I could see somebody saying, hey, would you bring some bear grease or some bear
meat? Right.
And I would be like,
yeah, it'll just
well, bear grease is a little bit harder to come by, yeah. But I would, I'd be like, sure. And so I texted Luke and I said, hey, what are the chances you could bring some crab? And he said, like frozen crab or like live crabs? And I was like, well, I don't even know what I'm asking for. You tell me, but live crabs sound pretty good. And it went something like that. And so what did you do?
Well, I like a challenge, you know? So I, and I'm in the, you know, I make videos. So I was like, you know, what would be an awesome thing, whether it went really well or really bad, is if I tried to get like live crabs to you guys on the airplane and not like check them, like carry them on the airplane with me. And I was like, I don't know if you can do that. They won't let you bring a bottle of shampoo, but I was like, you know, I think it'd be funny either way. You know what I mean? Like,
did you? Go ahead, keep going.
And I was doing this stuff before I even started social media. I'm the kind of guy who will go the extra mile for a laugh, you know what I mean, for yeah. me or somebody else. So I was like, I just thought it'd be, you know, an interesting thing to try anyway. So I, I got like a duffel bag, and I built a cooler inside the duffel bag, put the crabs in there, and then carried them on the airplane. So I have some pictures of me and my
and
crabs on the plane.
And when you put those crabs through the scanner, did no one just say like, can you open that up for me?
Surprisingly... No, I put them through the, you know, the X-ray machine.
But they'll stop a pair of fingernail clippers.
Yeah, though. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. But I seen it go through, and then it stopped, and my heart stopped. I was like, oh, no. And then it went back, and then it went through, and I seen the lady, like, pull the screen a little closer to her face, and it was, like, 4:30 in the morning. So I was like, I was like, there's either a chance they're going to be really grumpy, and they're going to give me a hard time, or they're going to be, like... It's too early for this. Just let it, you know, what, it's just Maryland things, like whatever. Just let, And then it went the third time, and it went through. I was like, oh, we're good. And so I got them behind security. And then the only issues I did have was trying to carry them on the actual airplane. They were going to try to make me check them there for a moment.
But that was a size issue.
That was a size issue. They didn't even know what was in it. You know what I mean?
They were like, they told them, hey, that bag's too big. And then what? Yeah, so she gave you a hard time.
She gave me a real hard time, and I was like, I can't check it. You know, I can't. You can't just like it's got to stay upright. And she's like, why?
It's a baby, because there's a baby.
I was like, well, you know, there's like it's full of seafood. She's like, okay. I was like, like live seafood. She's
you know,
like,
if you turn if you turn seafood over, it pours out.
That's right.
Right. I was like, I don't want to be you know carrying this. That was my first leg of the journey. I was like, I don't want to have to be carrying this.
What town was
thing.
This in?
That was in Baltimore, actually, that I was, you know, having the hard time getting on the airplane. So, you know, after some heated discussion and some other things, I finally did get it on the airplane with me and into the overhead compartment.
That's awesome.
They made them here, and only two crabs died. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, how many crabs do you think?
I think we had about three dozen.
Three dozen.
And
crabs.
I was expecting I was hoping to get about, you know, at least 50% here alive and well. But I tell you what, man, complimentary drinks, you know, on the plane, the crabs were good, you know, you give them some snacks, they were just fine, you know.
Do they like those little Biscoff crackers?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Yep. And a window seat. They love a window seat.
They do love a window seat. I do have a picture of me and my crab seeing the world together. These crabs have seen things other crabs could never dream of.
Montana Knife Company was founded by Josh Smith, one of the world's most experienced master bladesmiths. He's been making knives for 30 years, made in the USA and manufactured locally in Montana. The knives come with a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. Designed, tested, and built by hunters, MKC is a hunting knife company first and foremost. They have the sharpest knives out of the box and the easiest knives to sharpen. And that is the dadgum truth. You better be careful with them when you get them. They are sharp. MKC is a fast-growing company. They just hired their 55th employee and are looking to hire about 50 more in the next year or so. I've carried a lot of these Montana knives, and the one that I like the most is their Speed Goat, which is a lightweight hunting knife, just the right size. MKC knives sell out within minutes of being released. So head over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have new knives for sale every Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So check their website and sign up for their text and email alerts. That is the best way to find out when they have knives available. Use code BEARGREASE10 for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a gobbler turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time, Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. When you pour it in your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store. or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Did you have somebody sitting by you when you pulled that one out?
I did, and it was awkward. It was like, but the guy kind of was like...
Okay. There's multiple kind of interactions that you have with someone that sits with you on a plane.
Yeah.
There's like the no look. You know, there's like multiple options. There's the no look. No look, no talk.
Yep.
It's just like imaginary wall. Ignorance is bliss. Like, let's not do this. We're just.
Then there's me.
And then there's the kind of the southern, like, nice guy. Like, anybody you sit with, you need to greet them and. Where were you at on this?
You know, Baltimore, it's not really, it's more the, you know, I'm
the Baltimore stank eye.
Yeah, I'm upset that you have to be even on the same airplane as me. Yeah. Does it, even if you cured cancer, like that kind of hospitality. So
you didn't talk to this person.
No, I didn't say anything. It's kind of just best to, you know, I just kind of went about my business and I thought, you know what, there's days where you're that guy, you know?
Okay.
And these days are becoming more and more frequent with my life. Oddly enough, but I was just that guy. That guy that had a crab.
So you pulled a crab out. The guy beside you acknowledged it?
He kind of just, I think that he saw it. You know, he looked and he was just kind of like, he kind of acknowledged that he saw it because I saw his demeanor change. And then he just kind of like looked back forward and closed his eyes. I was like, I wonder if it's like, it's so early in the morning. Maybe this guy thinks like, there's no way I just saw this crab on an airplane.
You picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue.
Yeah. And then
I wonder if he thought it was like cooked seafood and he was like, oh, wow.
Or like a rubber crab or
4
something.
4 a.m. Yeah. The guy beside me is cracking crabs.
Right. See, that would have been funny to bring crabs, you know, cook crabs and eat them on the airplane on the way home. That would have been.
Well, so when he got them here, Josh, we did a big crab boil.
I love it.
We had steam.
We'll get some hate mail.
Sorry. Crabs in Maryland. We steamed them.
The most tragic thing about the whole scene, though, is that Clay made his regionally famous coleslaw. You know about this.
Oh, yeah, with the jalapeno coleslaw.
Can you confirm to them that it's regionally famous?
Yeah.
It's got cilantro.
Every Cajun. Church potluck, it's going to show up.
Yeah.
Every wedding on the Newcomb farm, it's going to show up.
I even hand chopped the cabbage this time.
Oh, wow.
It's a long story. I put it in the refrigerator to chill. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You do that with coleslaw, Josh. Yeah. Don't give me a...
But
Josh,
no, Josh no, gave me I'm the I'm like, eye where's like, this
why
going?
Are you chilling?
Oh, he's a crab airplane guy.
And so we go steam our crab.
Right.
And we have this huge meal. And we leave the coleslaw in the fridge.
Oh, shoot.
So we're gonna have some of Clay's famous coleslaw on the render before we end today. I'm kidding. That's a joke. But
you got Brent excited.
Well, let's eat.
So we start. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. Tell us how you steam crab.
We just put them in a pot. Probably like a canning pot or something.
Yeah,
whatever. We use what we got. You know what I mean? And put some water and vinegar in the bottom. And
what's the vinegar do?
The vinegar actually makes them easier to pick, so it keeps the meat from sticking to the shell so bad.
Interesting.
Yeah, so like if you use, like I've heard of guys using like seawater, not Chesapeake Bay water, but like seawater to steam seafood and stuff, or putting seasoning with salt in it in the water, and that seems like a great concept, but it makes the meat stick to the shell worse.
Okay.
So if you put a little white vinegar in there, maybe like 1/3 part white vinegar, you know, it'll
so
help
just water and
that kind of stuff always intrigues me, like how they figured it out.
Right, I was about to say the same thing.
Okay, give me that diesel.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that didn't work.
How about some WD-40? No, that didn't work either. What we got left? Here's some white vinegar.
Okay. It's like the same guy that figured out you could eat a crab.
Or a mushroom.
Who was the guy that decided that it didn't stick to the shell as bad?
Right. Yeah.
I mean,
probably the guy selling vinegar.
Yeah. Because the stuff we cooked in vinegar, I'd say the meat stuck to the shell.
Oh.
Last night? I mean, when we ate it?
It's kind of what happens.
Yeah, anyway. It does a little bit, but I'm telling you, it can be a lot worse. There's a lot of times where you're trying to get it, and it's like the meat stuck to itself that's like stuck to the shell. I don't know, it's hard to describe. But so, if I gave you two, you could probably pick out the one. I don't know. We may have to try for
science. These are blue crabs.
Mm-hmm.
And that, ironically, these actually probably came from Louisiana.
Yeah, Maryland blue crab season is closed right now.
So but they shipped them live from Louisiana to Maryland.
Yep.
and then you brought them from Maryland to Arkansas.
Wow, these are, man, those dudes have been around.
They're well-traveled.
These are blue crabs. What's the scientific name of them?
Calanectus sapidus.
And so the males are how big?
Males, I mean, they'll get up to, I mean, I've caught, like, the biggest one I've caught probably is, like, 9 inches point-to-point across the carapace, which is a giant. I mean, that's a massive crab. Usually when they get that big.
Did you mount it?
I didn't, but I have seen mounted crabs, but I don't have a mounted crab. That would be pretty cool, though.
Yeah.
I sold it, but, yeah, so, you know, they get that big, and usually the thing that gets them is either a waterman or they, you know, they die of shell rot. They get so big they can't shed. They don't have the energy to shed their shell anymore. Like, males will, in theory, just keep growing and growing and growing.
Oh, really?
Females, once they shed from an immature female to a mature female, that crab never sheds again.
Hmm. Interesting.
I'm surprised that in, like, water folklore, there's not a giant crab somewhere, like a whale
or
a squid.
Like a 6-foot crab?
Well, I mean, no, like a 20-foot crab.
Oh.
Like,
there could be. I mean, the thing is, you know, I use crab pots instead of, like, an alternative method to catching crabs in Maryland would be, like, a trout line where the crab is just holding onto a piece of bait, and then you're driving a boat along the line, and you put, like, you have a hook over the side, you put the line over the hook, and you're just driving along it, and the crabs will hold onto the bait till you get to the surface, and then you dip them off the line with a net.
Oh, wow.
So, in a crab pot, you can only catch a crab that will fit
kind of
through the
limiting
funnel.
The size,
you know what I mean?
Of the crab.
So they catch some real giants, you know, trout lining because it's just anything that can hold on.
But you
to
just
the
probably
bait.
Don't catch as many.
Well, there's different areas you can go. And, you know, I mean, when you're doing on a really large scale like what I'm doing, you know, you're fishing up to 1,400 crab pots when I have two licenses sometimes. You know, crab potting is kind of the way that you would go, you know, to do it on a really big scale.
Right.
I see. I see.
So, Luke, when I was a boy, I grew up on the Gulf.
I got caught in a crab pot.
We used to go crabbing.
Uh-huh.
And we had, my uncle had 2 crab pots, and then we'd just take the lines where he put the meat through, and mm-hmm. we'd pitch them out there, and we'd catch blue crabs there
really?
Near Galveston, yeah.
Huh. Just to eat? Just
yep.
Eat
take
the
them
house.
Home, steam them, and eat them.
Yeah, they're all over the East Coast
so
now.
So, blue crabs, are they all over the world, or just
I mean
America?
I know they have them in South America and Central America.
Same species.
I believe so. I've never been there to witness it, but I do think they do. I hear they don't get as big.
Okay.
But, you know, with East Coast going through, there's a lot of ecological change kind of going on in the northeast, you know, of the East Coast. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they're even finding blue crabs in Maine, you know, I know guys that lobster and that,
no, that
raise
oysters. To me, that
up
doesn't
there.
Sound like I figured they were already there. They're not.
They're not. No, they're not. But they're starting to show
so
up.
So it's
in
a southern,
like
Chesapeake Bay is the northern range of the blue crab.
Historically, is you know, yeah, like Chesapeake Bay, Delaware Bay. You know, I know they have some in New York and all, but it was kind of like, from what I understand, you know, that was kind of as far north. Like, you know, there's not a fishery for them in New York. I think.
If,
maybe there is.
Just as
know.
A little caveat, if the Arkansas Game and Fish finds some blue crab in the Arkansas River, it didn't have anything to do with us.
right.
No, absolutely.
So, yeah, like, I guess there is a fishery for blue crabs in New York. I don't know a ton about it, but, you know, that was kind of like as far north
okay.
as you really find them. But
so, when you eat these things, you said something when we started. You said blue crabs are the only thing you could starve while eating.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a surprisingly small amount of meat on a pretty big looking crab.
Yeah.
Would you have said that,
yeah.
Josh?
Oh, yeah.
But once you get into it, you realize it's the social aspect, and the meat is very, very good, and you have to work for it. So it's fun.
Generally, you supplement the crab with coleslaw.
Usually.
Yeah.
A good host would.
So, just quickly, tell me how you'd break down crab, like to eat it.
So,
if you just had to describe it to somebody in like a minute.
Yeah, break the claws off. You can get into the claws, eat that pretty pain-free. Then pick the apron off the bat, flip
Which
it over,
the
pick
big,
the apron.
It's like the hood, like the big
sort
part.
Of, yeah, yep. Yeah.
The bonnet, if you're in England.
Yeah, something
Wait,
like that.
When
it's reproductive
one
organ.
One of my, don't let this... this might indicate my socioeconomic status, but one of my biggest interactions with seafoods has been Captain D's. And at Captain D's, when you get the seafood platter, uh-huh. it actually has a real crab shell stuffed with, like, you know, crab
anything
dressing.
But crabs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably a real crab shell stuffed with, like, imitation crab or something
yeah.
like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, it was Cod. Good, though.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was a blue crab.
Possibly.
Probably. It's about the size of a blue crab.
It was
crab.
About as big yeah. as a yeah. mango.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, probably a blue crab, something like that.
From our mango tree in the yard.
Yeah, right.
Carry on.
Unit of
okay,
measure.
So you take the top big part of the shell off.
Yep, yeah. You'll pull the you know, the carapace off, and then you'll be left with the body. You'll see the lungs and then kind of like the guts in the center. You pull the guts out, looks like ramen noodles. You know, you don't want to eat the forbidden ramen noodles.
Okay.
You can, but I don't suggest it necessarily. And then they have lungs on either side.
Okay.
You'll pull them
off.
It's
like gills, like fish gills. Yeah.
Gills,
almost.
Lungs. There's some kind of thing
well,
about
I mean,
them because they can live out
like
of
that. That's what they look like. Yeah.
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 They look like gills.
Yeah.
Pull them off. You don't really want to eat them. And then I take the body, break it in two pieces. You know, it'll split into two even pieces. And then, you know, I usually flip it over and you'll be able to see the lines down the, you know, the underside of the crab. And I'll kind of take my two thumbs and break them along those lines. And then you can kind of crack the top and then pull the meat out of all the little compartments. You know, I like to keep it still attached to the legs. It just gives you, you know, for dipping and whatever
yeah.
else. Because a lot of times we'll dip
you
them
know,
in butter.
It helped
and
me,
stuff
now
like
that you're describing it, and I've done it now, it helps me to think about it like this. The muscles, there are muscles attached to things that have to move.
Yeah.
And there's a muscle attached to every leg. So it's a, it has eight legs, right?
Yeah.
Eight
something
legs
like
and
that.
Two pinchers.
Something like
or
that.
Or maybe six.
I don't think it's eight legs
six
and two
legs.
Pinchers.
Six legs. It's got a lot.
I think it's got three legs, a swim fin, and a pincher on each side, I believe.
Okay, so that's four appendages.
You ain't no crabber.
Yeah,
I ain't no crabber. But like every leg has a little tuft of meat, like
right.
like a tiny little bit yeah. of meat. And so you're basically cracking off that leg and pulling it out so that meat kind of like comes out with it. And then you have this little crab hole hand, you know, handle of the leg, and then you dip that in some melted butter, touch it into a little bit of a little seasoning that you have. And then you eat it. And so you do that with all the legs, and then you've cracked the claws, which not all of them had claws.
Yeah, some well, sometimes a lot of times the claws fall off when you're steaming them and all.
Okay.
You know, they're in there fighting, you know, whatever. They don't go out without a fight, you know.
Why is it so hot in here?
Like in a restaurant, when you get crabs, a lot of times they
one
have
one of his wife is like, can you turn up the heat? It's freezing.
Yeah, right. In a restaurant, they would either shock the crabs, electrocute them, or ice them. You know,
really?
And, huh. Like flash ice them. Usually they electrocute him.
Wow.
What do you do for a living? I electrocute crabs.
Yeah, right, right. The merchant of crustacean death. But that's so that...
It's a new tattoo.
Steam them so they don't fight in the pot,
oh,
so they don't drop their
claws. Oh, it has nothing to do with animal ethics or anything.
Well, I mean, maybe. I don't know. But I mean, I know in the industry it's like so that... Because, you know, if you're serving crabs at a restaurant, people will complain sometimes. They don't have all
pinchers.
The claws, even if they're like there. They want a crab with all their
yeah,
appendages.
Yeah,
so
you say, I'm on it.
You shock them.
It's kind of like a gladiator fight when you throw them all in that pot and then put the lid on.
Oh, yeah. We put the lid on, and we had some potatoes and corn on the top. And I think Missy said something about, like, it's moving.
There was a cob of corn up there. It was going, yeah, wiggling back and forth.
The lid starts kind of moving a little bit. I was like, yeah, it's just we'll check in on them in like 10
well,
minutes.
What I learned is that it's like extremely, like Luke said, it's full contact sport. Like, you know, we had crabs just everywhere. It's like you have a huge pile of just stuff. But at first, when I was watching him do it, I was like, holy cow, this is going to be wild. Because he was like, don't eat this. Don't eat the lungs. There's what he called the mustard in them, which is the fat, which just looks like this like pasty yellow. I mean, it'd be like, you'd think, don't eat that. But it kind of gets on everything, and it's actually really good.
Yeah.
So there was nothing that I put in my mouth from that crab didn't taste incredible. So I kind of got it. I was like, oh, you don't have to be afraid of anything.
Right.
You just like go to town. And it was great. Minus
definitely
the coleslaw.
Full contact sport eating crabs for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a big crawfish ball on steroids.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a little
messier.
I could see
yeah.
I could see how if you really knew what you were doing, I mean, you'd just
If you try not to make a mess, crab. Eat them outside or in the bathtub, because you're going to get it everywhere.
Luke, what's your record of eating crabs? How many crabs have you eaten?
I mean, you know, in one sitting?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, usually by the time I've, you know, if I really get it, you know, the tunnel vision on eating the crabs, it's kind of like everything else just kind of fades
off
away.
You
know what I mean? So it's kind of like you just kind of wake up in the
morning, zone.
Like, covered in Old Bay or J.O. seasoning. And
can't remember like, what happened.
Why am I in Arkansas?
I'm in
wakes up in a ditch the next morning.
I don't even remember bringing these on the plane.
Okay, if I'm going to do a crab boil for family and friends, crab steam.
Yeah, you don't
how
do
many
a boil
crabs,
for your family and friends. How you do many, steams.
How many crabs do I need to factor in per person?
I mean, you could count on like you know if your friends are from Maryland, uh-huh. I would count on 10 crabs a man
per person.
Per person.
Oh you know wow. I mean? Wow!
Depending on the size of the crab makes all the difference.
Right. Of course.
We didn't have any giant extra jumbos because I was trying to could only bring so many on the plane. I was trying to get a little more in case some died. You know
I sent
mean?
A picture okay. of that to Michael Roseman when they were all laid out on the table. You know, his wife's from Maryland, and she said, "What's everybody else going to eat? I could eat all that by myself."
Yeah, I would say if I'm eating like large crabs, which are like my largest are 6 to 6.5 inches across the top.
Okay,
you know I could count on eating between 10 and 12 myself.
10 and 12.
But I'm a very efficient crab eater. You know,
right.
I don't. I actually don't eat crabs that often. You know what I mean? That's like Biggie Smalls breaking his 8th crack commandment, man. You can't get high on your own supply. You know what I mean?
There's a lot to unpack in that.
That reference will play with a lot of Bear Grease.
Yeah, right?
That's good. Yeah,
wow.
It was so good.
I was going to say 4 crabs.
Okay.
After 4 crabs, I was wore out.
It's like, can I just get some sausage?
I mean, true story. I ain't no crabber. It was a lot of
fun.
Can
you imagine steaming a live deer?
And just eating it with your hands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dump it out on the table?
Don't give him any ideas.
Yeah. That's a great idea.
We'll be doing that next.
Which of you listening right now took a class in school about Family Finances 101? No one? Yeah, me neither. Like the importance of a will or college savings plan or even life insurance or estate planning. We have to know these things. But how do we figure it all out? That's why I'm excited to partner with Fabric by Gerber Life. Life insurance is important to me. It just gives me security in knowing that if anything happened to me, my family would remain financially stable in my absence. Fabric by Gerber Life is term life insurance you can get done right here, right now. You can be covered from your couch in under 10 minutes with no health exam required. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/bear. That's meetfabric.com/bear. MEET fabric.com/bear. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company. Not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Montana Knife Company was founded by Josh Smith, one of the world's most experienced master bladesmiths. He's been making knives for 30 years. Made in the USA and manufactured locally in Montana. The knives come with a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. Designed, tested, and built by hunters, MKC is a hunting knife company first and foremost. They have the sharpest knives out of the box and the easiest knives to sharpen. And that is the dadgum truth. You better be careful with them when you get them. They are sharp. MKC is a fast-growing company. They just hired their 55th employee and are looking to hire about 50 more in the next year or so. I've carried a lot of these Montana knives. And the one that I like the most is their Speed Goat, which is a lightweight hunting knife, just the right size. MKC knives sell out within minutes of being released. So head over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have new knives for sale every Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So check their website and sign up for their text and email alerts. That is the best way to find out when they have knives available. Use code BEARGREASE10 for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a goblin turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring.
Man, I hate to change the topic from crabbing, but we got some serious conversation to have here about a podcast that I've been working on and excited about for probably over a year. Like, the sequence of the way these things happen when I do a series is it's not always a year, but usually I'm reading a book or doing something that's connected to something that will materialize much later. I think last summer, maybe last spring, I started reading Roderick Nash's book, Wilderness in the American Mind. This book was written, let me see what the copyright date is. This is going to blow your mind. This book, first edition published in 1967.
Oh, wow.
This book is considered the quote unquote book of Genesis of, this book is a mandatory prelude to any modern treatment of conservation problems. Here's another one. When Roderick Nash's Wilderness in the American Mind first appeared in 1967, it was justly praised as the first real idea book in environmental history. Indeed, a classic study and greatly influenced another. That's not what I'm looking for. This is the Book of Genesis of American wilderness.
Do you have any
pictures? This guy was getting his PhD in 1967, wrote this book. When I read this book, I cannot fathom what a human would have to go through to gather the information he did and cover it in such an incredible way. This is a top five book for me in the world.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like massively influential because it unveiled for me things that were happening inside of me that I didn't know why. And that's something I'm very interested in all areas of life. I popped out of the womb in 1979 in Arkansas. And I have this view of the world, these ideas about different things. How much of that did I come up with on my own? How much of it I came up because of my individual family? How much did I come up with it because of the culture that I'm raised in? How much did I come up with it because I am an American? Like, where does this stuff come from? And to me, that's all real important because you will live a life of deception if you think, I mean, this whole idea of being like a free thinker and like we're these independent people that just came up with all this stuff on our own and nobody tells me what to do. It's like, dude, you are a product of your culture because your culture valued that. Your culture valued you saying that you're the only one who ever thought of this and you're this autonomous man. And I love that. But what I'm saying is that came from somewhere.
Yeah.
This whole idea of like rugged individualism of the American is kind
you're
of
influenced by everything is an influence, either positive or negative.
Well, and a whole lot of the way that we think.
Unless you're Steve Rinella.
Well, we're going to get to that. When Roderick Nash started talking about wilderness, I was like, yeah, yeah. And I had no idea. He was talking about all this deep history about this was way different than like the Donnie Baker story. I mean, like radically, like if an alien came down and analyzed this podcast, they would be like, two different people must have made that for because it's like very different,
right?
Which I like. I like that it went from this very personal story to something. I don't view it as academic, but it is philosophical. And philosophy, to me, philosophy is really functional. because to have an understanding of who you are, you have to kind of know why. And I've always loved the idea of wilderness, but also wilderness with a capital W. But so this book just specs it out. And so much, I got to give Roderick Nash credit, so much of what I talked about in this first episode came from this book. And I tried to get Roderick Nash, who's still alive, he's in his 80s, tried to get him on this here podcast, and he wouldn't do it. Hmm. And I'm not afraid to say that because it's just the truth. Good. I have a lot of respect for what he wrote. But holy smokes, did I have a cast of characters, though. Dr. Dan Flores, incredible guy. Just came out with a new book called Wild New World. He wrote Coyote America. He wrote American Serengeti, which if you hadn't read American Serengeti, you ain't no crabber.
If there's not pictures, then I ain't read it. Most crabbers probably ain't read it. Well, to be honest with you.
American Serengeti is basically about the Pleistocene North America. It's just mind-boggling. Oh, burritos are ready. Yeah. Colby Moorhead came over here the other day and told me how to make that battery pack stop beeping, and I forgot what he said. So every time it beeps in this podcast, we're giving one of the listeners a coonskin hat. Not true. American Serengeti talks about Pleistocene North America, and basically that we had more charismatic megafauna than even Africa, like what we looked at. You know, we had the bison. We had like multiple giant cats. We had horses. We had 2,000-pound giant ground sloth. We had cave bears. We had dire wolves. I mean, it was like Jurassic Park here. Anyway, Dan Flores wrote a book on that. He's number one. Number two is Dr. Sarah Dant. It's Dan's wife. I think the world knows that.
Their dinner table conversations probably got a limited.
Oh, they're like the most interesting people of all time. So she's a professor at Weber University in Utah, and she wrote this book called Losing Eden, which is an environmental history of the West. It is like so much packed with deep human history on the landscape of North America, kind of mind-blowing book too. And so she's on there. And then Steve Rudella, who I'm interested to see what y'all's take on the Steve Rudella section was. Steve's always great to have on. He's great. And then one of my favorites, Hal Herring, is a character. If you don't know Hal, then you ain't no crabber. But Hal Herring, great guy. Where to start?
I mean, you said that the Donnie Baker, this really aren't related, but I mean, it kind of is, though. I mean, you can't tell me, even though Donnie Baker, what he did, I mean, he shared all the same interests in the wild and that we do, you know, and that everybody else did. So really, it's kind of almost the origin story of the whole thing, you know? It's like starting. You just had the Franks before the beans a little bit. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well,
I don't think it's not that unrelated. It's like, you know, his desire to be out in the wilderness and take deer and do whatever else, even though it went a little sideways there for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, probably has the same roots and ideas. Saying.
So he was going to an area that had unmolested animals that were easy to hunt.
Yeah, exactly.
To me, that was the most interesting thing. One of the most interesting things in the podcast is that this, what we now view as a love of wilderness and us like federally preserving wilderness areas, goes back deep into our epigenetics, as Dan Flores said, when we loved places that were absent of humans because we could go there and be successful hunting because the animals were undisturbed. I mean, that's like wildly fascinating.
I feel like this podcast made me more contemplative about it than I've ever been, because I think when you say the word wilderness, it does evoke an emotional response to a lot of people. And I thought, what is wilderness really, you know, beyond the definition? What does it mean to me? Because, you know, we've traveled a lot with our kids to national parks and whatnot. Yeah. And, you know, you see the capital W Wilderness, and you kind of go out there and you see the paved parking lot and you see all the trails and, you know, the signs that say.
Now, that wouldn't be capital W Wilderness. That would be a national park.
Well,
a
national park. But we have seen wilderness areas.
Yes, yes.
And it just, you're like, that doesn't, it is. I mean, if you can drive.
It's hard.
Yeah. So.
Oh, but, well, you're talking about national parks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
oh, gotcha, gotcha.
But the idea of wilderness is, to me, is captivating with a side of terrifying.
Mm.
Because I
thought you were going to say captivating with a capital C.
No, captivating like I am just bewildered by it, and I'm drawn to it. But at the same time, there is that aspect of like it's wild. I mean, it is like it's unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And going back to what I talked about this before, if we're going to talk about wilderness, you can't talk about it without the movie The Wilderness Family.
And I didn't bring them up in this.
But, you know, I think about that idea of being dropped off in the middle of nowhere and being forced to make something of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain things like we talked about unmolested animals, but also at the same time there is a raw wildness about it. I thought that I thought the etymology of your word there was fascinating.
I got chills listening to that yesterday in the truck coming home from squirrel hunting.
So
with
I
a stringer of squirrels in the back truck.
I love it. I'm excited about hearing more about it because it is a thing that is unique. I've never thought about a wilderness being something that when you lose it, you don't get it back.
Right.
I'm not. It's hard to wrap your mind around.
It doesn't come back.
Yeah. It's done.
Yeah.
So we have a potentially extinctable resource that really does need to be cared for. And so I appreciate the deep dive.
Well, I think it's important to understand like this broader scale of humanity. Humans as a species coming out of being hunter-gatherers, moving towards civilization, which civilization would be defined by agriculture and domestic animals and congregation of people, which would have increased birth rates, produced a lot of more security. As people were coming out of wilderness into that, there was this very long-standing human idea that wilderness was bad. Even though we were drawn to it as hunter-gatherers to go into places that were unexploited, when all of a sudden there was a new option, we were very interested in becoming, and again, civilized is a politically incorrect term that I'm going to use because we just have to understand what we're talking about. You know, because when you say civilized, it insinuates that there are humans that live uncivilized lives, and right, so that's politically incorrect. But you understand what I'm saying. So when all of a sudden the security of civilization was here, there was like, let's say 99% of people were very interested in getting to that so that they didn't die when they were 18 years old from starvation or from a woolly mammoth tusk in the butt. You know,
you'll have that.
Yeah. I mean, took it right in the
old piece. So
but the tables shifted as civilization then dominated the face of the earth. And then all of a sudden there's this artifact where we woke up in the 1800s, the Romantic era, and all of a sudden it became cool to love wilderness. So, I mean, it's like this sloshing from one side to the other. Wilderness is our enemy. We have to get to civilization. And then it became civilization is the enemy. That's what Thoreau and Emerson and Muir, and we have to get back to wilderness. And then today we live in a world that's so lopsided in civilization. There's those of us who are scrapping and wanting to interact with and go to a place that's such an anomaly across the face of the earth where we could go and experience a place that people don't live. That is, you know, that's interesting.
You think about, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, you just think about the you talked about the romanticism of it, and in our realm where we work here, the majority of the products that we sell, that we offer for sale, that we use, are all geared to make going into the wilderness easier.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's how we make a living.
Boots and waterproof clothing.
And backpacks and being lighter weight and being able to carry more stuff with you that you need to survive at a time out there when back in those days it was hard. You know, you had to, it was just a bigger struggle. And we're doing it now, not for survival, but for pleasure, for fun, to fill that need that we have, that we wake up, that we long to get away from everything that's around us, all these light bulbs and stuff. You know, we, all the time I'm here, we're working, we're hunting yesterday, I'm answering text messages and emails while I'm on the back of that mule. And we get out there, when there's none of that, it's a whole different way to look at a sunrise, or the way to look at riding down a road or walking down a road when you're so far removed from it. I had the thought that in there where he said that it's in our nature to long for those places to go, and I'm obviously paraphrasing what he said, but what I got out of what he was talking about was it's in our DNA, in our genetic code, to want to go to the wild place. My wife thinks if we're in a town that doesn't have a Target, that's about as wilderness as it gets.
That's a wilderness area.
She don't want any part of that. She wants to go the opposite direction. So, you know, but she wouldn't like to go to in the middle of live in the middle of Baltimore, or even in the middle of Little Rock. That's too congested. She wants somewhere in the happy medium that's still got the security that you can go here and there with very little trouble. Me, on the other hand, give me a coal oil lamp and a pocket full of shells and a shotgun, and I'm going to be fine just wherever I can get away from people.
Mm-hmm.
So there, at some point, you know, it was a pendulum.
Yeah.
At some point, some folks still followed that.
Yeah.
That want or that need to do something, and then some folks didn't. I mean, they stopped it. At the edge, you know, this is far enough. But there's still others that want to go further out.
Yeah.
And it had to be that way, or this country wouldn't be where it is now.
Yeah.
You know, with exploration. Mm-hmm. That was just something that I thought about.
Luke, what'd you think?
Well, I just kind of had a thought about kind of the irony of, like, you were talking about, you know, humans' desire to recognize and preserve wilderness and wild places. And it's kind of the same theme here, is where everything has gone so full circle, where, like, in an effort to do that, we have places like Yellowstone, which to me is the least wild wilderness that you could experience. You know what I mean?
Like, 3 million people a year.
Right, exactly. Like, so it's sort of like, I think it's just one of the common denominators of human nature. You know what I mean? The same thing that drives people like us to go experience places where there is no one else. The same, you know, that's what the people that discovered new continents and, you know, Americas and whatever else had in them. You know what I mean? But there's always, you know, I think it's getting kind of bred out of us. You know what I mean? It used to be 1 in 10 people. Now it's 1 in 1 million people that want to go, have that desire to, like, go out and see that. But, you know, I don't know. My thought was,
you said something about scarcity earlier, about how, do you remember how you said scarcity is the humans always gravitate towards what's scarce?
And so you kind of just want what you can't have. I mean, everything in human nature is kind of like that.
When we were forging a living out of the wilderness, we wanted more security.
Right.
Then now that we're forging a living out of civilization, we want to reach back to something more wild.
It's just, I think, humans' desire to really just kind of want what is scarce and want what they kind of can't have. You know, it's like, it's one of the downfalls of man. You know,
it's all
one
cyclical.
Of the things that sets us apart from animals.
Which is, in a sense, the antithesis of wilderness, because the only way to keep wilderness
is to keep
a bunch of people out of it.
Yeah, never.
You
go
know
there.
What I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, well, we have these people who want it, but how many people being there makes it not wilderness
right,
anymore.
Right, right. That's why I was saying, where is the line of wilderness?
Okay, you guys are totally ruining episode two. I wasn't even going to bring it up. No, yeah, there is a major philosophical problem with wilderness.
Yeah.
Is that wilderness is a wilderness because nobody's there.
Because you're not there.
Yeah.
Exactly. So once you go there, then is it still wilderness?
And okay,
though we have this natural desire just baked into us to experience what is wild.
You just listened to episode two. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Check back for
Let's just do another render now.
Yeah, let's just go right to the next render. No, that we get into that pretty extensively about these issues with wilderness. And there's another big issue that I'm not going to bring up just yet, unless one of y'all leaks it out on accident.
Stumbles
Don't
on.
Do it. Don't do it.
No.
Montana Knife Company was founded by Josh Smith, one of the world's most experienced master bladesmiths. He's been making knives for 30 years, made in the USA and manufactured locally in Montana. The knives come with a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. Designed, tested, and built by hunters, MKC is a hunting knife company first and foremost. They have the sharpest knives out of the box and the easiest knives to sharpen. And that is the dadgum truth. You better be careful with them when you get them. They are sharp. MKC is a fast-growing company. They just hired their 55th employee and are looking to hire about 50 more in the next year or so. I've carried a lot of these Montana knives, and the one that I like the most is their Speed Goat, which is a lightweight hunting knife, just the right size. MKC knives sell out within minutes of being released, so head over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have new knives for sale every Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So check their website and sign up for their text and email alerts. That is the best way to find out when they have knives available. Use code BEARGREASE10 for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a goblin turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring. We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that's stood the test of time: Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. It's really simple. You pour it in your gas tank. Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it clean your fuel system. You probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again. People everywhere rely on Seafoam to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. Help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
I have this desire in me that drives me to do what I do for a living. You know, this crab, and it's like this kind of desire to be where people aren't, you know, where there's like an even playing field between you and nature in a way, you know what I mean? Where like, you know, your rules and, you know, kind of man's societal boundaries don't apply to, you know, like the crabs, fish, the bay where I'm at. It doesn't, none of that matters. You know what I mean? That is all off the table. It's between you and, you know, and nature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So to me, it's a wild place, and I'm drawn to it just for no, it's just, it's in me. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I live in this, in just below like Baltimore City. I mean, there's tons, people are nuts to butts there. You know, it's just, we're jammed up. But I have this desire to get to the closest place I can and spend the most amount of time there, even if it's 100 times more work, you know, just because I have this thing baked into me for like this longing for wild things and wild places. And like, so I think it just kind of, it's different for everybody. Like,
he's
for me,
a true representation of it, because it's not a legacy thing with him.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
He's like a first generation crabber in his family. So there's something there somewhere.
Yeah. Well, and your example is relevant to all of us, is that the idea of wilderness you can experience anywhere. Like you in the Chesapeake Bay, which is not federal wilderness with a capital W, which is not wilderness by many definitions, but you're having that experience of like what Hal Herring said. He said wilderness is a feeling where you enter into a place that's no longer governed by the laws of men. You're governed by ancient laws.
Yeah, exactly.
And it, boy, that, I mean, that's for real. Like,
and I ain't read that book, I promise.
What? No. Isn't Hal's book. Hal Herring said that on the podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that is another critique of wilderness, Josh, is that Dan Flores talked about how we've sacralized. He said a lot of different groups have sacralized wilderness to the point that you might get the idea that that tree out in your yard is not nature too. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like you minimize something that's wilderness. On my property right here, I could experience that feeling of wilderness. I mean, it's kind of funny.
Right.
I have a small piece of land, and when I go to particular parts of it, it's the wildest part of the land that I have.
Right.
Which is not wilderness by any definition, but it feels, I have that feeling of this is a special place. This is furthest from my house.
I mean, I feel that way. I feel that way when I'm on the river. Like I'm in a spot where not everybody can get to. You know, when I'm in my boat and I'm you know, cruising down there, that I have that feeling like of there is something wild and connects me to nature inside of it that's just mine in the moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can experience, you know, I have been out crabbing and I am experiencing, you know, that same thing. Well, there's $1 million yacht going by me 50 feet away.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So we're in the same place doing the same thing, but I'm experiencing, you know, idea of wilderness, and this guy's probably just drinking Michelob Ultras at 9 a.m. on his $1 million yacht. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's just such a weird thing. It's like a totally separate, you know, the feeling, I guess, of wilderness and then, you know, actual wilderness to, I would guess, probably two different podcasts, really.
Well, you may have tapped into episode 3 right there.
Well, I didn't mean to.
No, I'm kidding.
I think that the spiritualizing of wilderness, really, it's true. You know, I think we've all experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
If you've been somewhere remote and you've seen a breathtaking mountainscape with a sunrise that just blows your mind how the Creator could have made that for you to see that morning, I think a big aspect to it is the removal of noise from your mind, from your life, from your agenda, that makes that thing that much more intense and gives you that experience.
Yeah. What's unique about that is people have different words to describe it, that there's no humans that deny that happens.
Yeah.
Like there's, you know, you use the term creator. There would be people that would not use that term. The one thing that's for certain is that people, whether they believe in a God or don't believe in a God, have a spiritual, and you know, people might have different definitions of what a spiritual experience would be, but nobody is arguing that when you stand on top of some beautiful summit and see a sunrise, that there is a sublime feeling, like the guy Burke, he popularized that word. The sublime is like the overlap of the natural and the spiritual, and that is what is not up for debate, is that something happens that's bigger than just normal human stuff, which I think that's incredible.
Yeah.
That we're not arguing about this thing that happens. And it would make sense, maybe even biologically, that it doesn't make sense that that would happen unless we were coded to respond to these things, which I think we are.
Yeah, and they talked about people gravitating toward art, paintings and stuff that was the landscape.
Wasn't that interesting?
Yeah, that was the trees were just limbs or whatever were just laden with fruit.
Yeah,
that hadn't been picked and hadn't fallen
animals off. that were didn't look scared. Do you remember the guy? Go ahead.
Well, I was just you and I experienced in Canada in Saskatchewan when the bears were the famous bear that poked his head in the in the blind on us, and all the bears that were walking around us, they had no fear of us. They were absolutely unmolested.
Yeah,
and they had no knowledge of that. Was one of my top experiences ever.
Yeah, they just weren't afraid of us.
They weren't afraid.
Do you remember the guy had on from, I don't even remember which Bear Grease it was, but one of the Bear Greases where a guy told us that people respond to landscape art with humans that are in cover. Like, so if you had a picture of a group of people like out in the middle of a field, you would be more drawn to a picture of people that were close to a bluff
because there's a vulnerability.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing. It's different. It's different than wilderness.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
Dan Flores was talking about how we respond to unmolested scenes of calm animals, fruit trees that hadn't been picked, like stuff like that. But there's like deeper stuff. There's stuff so coded into us that like we want to be close to cover. Anyway, I just thought human response to landscape art is pretty
versus a photograph of a bison goring a national park visitor.
Yeah, I dig those myself. You get what you pay for, idiot.
Well, then, do you think the coding is just a desire for food, water, and shelter?
Well,
you know what I mean,
it's
the same kind of response.
It's deep rooted, no doubt.
Yeah. I mean, there are things built inside of us that help us survive, but I don't think that that comes at the exclusion of what Josh said. I do believe that the beauty and intricacy and architecture of the natural world, what it does for me, and I think I speak for a lot of people, it does draw me to a creator. Like there's the old thing about if you walked out into a field and you found a watch laying in a field, Josh.
Okay.
You'd pick it up.
And then you'd know what time it was.
You would know what time it was, but you would go, who put this watch here?
Yeah.
Who made this watch?
Or a stone point.
And you walk out into nature, and we see something that's far more complex, far more designed, far more intricate, far more intelligent than the making of a watch. And we say, well, should the question be who made this?
Right.
You know. So to me, that like a sunrise evokes inside of me a connection, a desire for a connection to my creator. That is not exclusive to. It's also deeply biological and epigenetics. Like my biophilia. E.O. Wilson wrote a book called Biophilia, which means that we have philia means like an obsession with.
Right.
We have an obsession with life. We're the only species on planet Earth that has an obsession with other animals' lives, other than like a prey, like a predator and a prey or whatever. But like we want to domesticate animals. We're interested, and that has been the biological thing that's made us so successful is this love of life. And it's like that's deeply coded inside of us. I think that's also a big part of what makes us human and have this consciousness. But what I'm saying is that you can have this spiritual thing happening and the natural thing at the same time. What were you going to say, Luke?
So I was just thinking this is maybe jumping ahead or whatever, but it was just
to episode 4.
That was the Ranella thing I was thinking about.
Uh-huh.
So he's talking about, what was it, the North Slope of Alaska?
The North Slope of the Brooks Range.
Is the most wild.
Yeah.
Well, what if he's sitting there glassing and he sees a goat with a collar on it? You know what I mean? Does that make it less wild to him? Does that take away? Is it no longer wild because that animal has been molested by man? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I mean, what's that scenario? Like, where's, I guess, I don't know if that goes into where the line is. I'd be curious to say, I'd be curious to hear what he has to say about
he said
something
that.
Like that.
He's addressed that before. And he said it would ruin it for him.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because another human's already touched that animal.
I sort of have the same kind of thought. I was just thinking about it like, you know, that's the most wild place you can think, but what if that's what he, you know, saw there? Would he, what would he have to say about
There's
that?
There's a lot of paradoxes inside it today because of the scarcity of wilderness. You know, the question is there really even wilderness left? I mean,
putting a collar on the goats, man's, you know, trying to preserve wilderness, you know what I mean? Steve makes it less wild. It's just like this
there
whole
are some
crazy
places,
thing.
I mean, there are some places on Earth that are untouched. I mean, there's some places where I think things exist that we don't... I mean, definitely in the sea, you know what I mean? We have places where humans have never even seen.
Only crabbers.
That's right. But
he said humans.
Yeah. We're not human.
But there's some places in Africa that are pretty, that they don't think, they're so adverse to.
Where are you getting this information about Africa?
I was reading about, it's been years since I read about this, but they think there are creatures in there that humans haven't seen.
Right, deep in the jungles.
Yeah.
But on a landscape level, I don't think Africa is like the place to think about. I'm not arguing with you.
I see your point, but.
I think the bigger unmolested landscapes in the world are in the closer to the north, the poles. I mean, Antarctica obviously is probably the
would most wilderness genuine be wilderness. more abundant in places that are more harsh?
Yeah,
like harsh 100%. Climate.
Yeah, because humans are wanting to live in places that are favorable,
right? They're comfortable,
and so
that's why there's no wilderness in Kansas.
Right, it's all very profitable
Ohio.
Land. And what we're going to talk about too in episode two, here we go, is that there's a thing called the rock and ice wildernesses. The wildernesses that we have today are preservation of places that were unusable, and so that's the reason we don't have very many prairie wildernesses. Imagine having a section of prairie in Kansas,
right?
That burritos are ready.
Oh, I'm hungry.
giving away our second coonskin cap. Imagine having a 4 million acre wilderness in.
Well, what do you think? You know, you say the word wilderness, and I immediately think of mountains and trees.
Yep.
I mean, I see a picture.
You have been marketed to your whole life.
Oh, yeah.
That's what wilderness is.
You're a sucker.
Yeah. You're just the average sucker.
Kind of a funny thing is, like, if you were to ask a lot of people, like, what's the most wild thing you can think of or wild place? Like, so many people would probably say something like Mount Everest, you know?
Mm.
Yeah.
It's like the least wild mountain there is. You know what I mean? Just because of the people and, you know, whatever else. It's just
lines of people.
Yeah.
No, and it was interesting. So we're building a case that not that it's better or worse, but that the American worldview on wilderness is different than the rest of the world. And I think by the end of this, that we're going to quantify that to a pretty heavy degree.
You're trying to tell me that Canadians don't care about wilderness?
Well, that's what Steve Rinella was trying to tell us. No, and his point was, I left that in there, honestly, just because it was entertaining. When I was having this conversation with Steve, I
was
like,
colorful,
this isn't working out like I thought it would. But I felt like it was valuable because I wanted to include it because he's right. Like, we're not
right.
I don't want this to be like, wow, look how great Americans are. We're superior to the rest of the world because we've preserved wilderness. But at the same time, America was America pioneered for. I believe this to be true, and I don't say this with arrogance. And we have international listeners. Don't get your feelings hurt. America pioneered modern ideas on conservation and wilderness for a lot of the world to follow. I mean, we were the first place that had designated wilderness areas. We were the first place that had public lands that were open for people to hunt, trap, fish, recreate. Like, nobody else was doing that.
We also have the in America, we have the luxury to do that.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that's...
So it's not just from the merit of our own soul. Right. It's Exactly.
You know, I just know from dealing with all the things that, you know, I'm kind of dealing with the Bay right now, it's like, when I really think about it, and you think, you know, the whole, you know, we're dealing with issues in the Bay, but, you know, they're dealing with issues 1,000 times worse all over the world. And you're like, if you're going to stop the pollution or this or that, like, you got to fix it in China and India. Well, you know, being able to have the luxury of caring about the wilderness and the animals that live there is a very, you know, it's a privilege. You know what I mean? It's a first world.
It's a product of economic.
Yeah.
Having money.
Prosperity.
Yeah, because in a lot of the world,
it's a luxury to be
in
able
a lot
to
of the world,
those
they yeah. they've exploited yeah. massive amounts of what they have just because they could. And we're not exempt either. Part of America's success on preservation of wilderness was simply that we had a huge continent. You know,
filled with resource.
Yes.
That they use the resource there to like become kind of it's like we just barely, you know what I mean? On a graph, just barely crossed right before it was too late. You
exactly.
know what I mean? It's like we came here, basically, you know, took from the land as much as we could, but it put us in a position where we were. Now we, you know, we have the luxury of caring about the land that we had right. left. You know, saving and, this last little and, bit and, took 95% to get there to be able to have that luxury.
Yes,
in reality, I think.
Yeah, that's you a know? Great. That's a great.
And
way
then
to
we
describe
were able
it.
To take that. We, you know, we had the privilege of taking that 5% and preserving it. You know, so it's like I yeah. think America just barely saved it. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Like, yeah.
In a lot of
I was surprised to learn that 5% of America is federal capital W wilderness.
5%.
That's a lot.
Are there like bulks of that in different areas? Like
well,
I would think
I mean,
Alaska.
If you had listened to the podcast, you would have heard that. that there are 806. I'm kidding, Josh. 800. There are 806 federal wilderness areas.
Right.
The bulk of the big chunks in volume are in Alaska.
Okay.
Like, there's huge wilderness in Alaska. And then the Bob Marshall is a huge wilderness that's in Montana. Mm-hmm. The Selway. Somebody's going to tell me I'm crazy. The Bob Marshall. How big is the Bob Marshall? Somebody look up how big the Bob Marshall is.
I got it.
It is a massive chunk of land. We have a lot of wildernesses in the east that are very small, like under 10,000 acres,
right.
which are extremely valuable. But you could fit all of Georgia's wilderness, every one of them, into like a teeny tiny corner of the Bob Marshall.
More right. than a million and 1.5 million acres.
1.5
for
million
Bob Marshall.
Acres. Yeah.
Look up some of the other wildernesses in Alaska, like the biggest Alaskan wilderness with a capital W.
I would argue that the reason those places are still so wild is because it was not easy to get there and profit off of the land.
100%.
You know?
Yeah. It is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no giant cities in Alaska that sprawl across the half the place, you know, because it's just hard to get there and it's not profitable, and, you know?
And it's wilderness. Wilderness is extremely controversial. It's controversial today.
57.5 million acres of designated wilderness in Alaska.
Wow.
Out of 222 million federal acres. Federal
How much
land.
Of Canada is that? I mean,
well, Canada's not
like 90% probably.
I mean, but they don't have
federal designation.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's a different
Queens,
country.
It's Queensland up there. Or Kingsland now.
Yeah. Crown
what they call
land.
It? Crown land, yeah. Whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't know if
hockey land.
Canada probably has some type of wilderness, but I wouldn't know what it's called. It's not the same as ours. I mean, it's not. We're not counting their land in ours. You know, yeah. I mean, even
it's
though Canada is basically
A.
the 51st state, we all know that.
You're not making any friends right now,
Canada. I love you. love you so much. I really do. I love Canada. Well. I spent a lot of time in Canada.
The geese are excellent.
Well, for fear that we're going to spoil the rest of these episodes, this has been a good. This has been a great start.
Yeah,
I love this topic. I'm serious. I love it, and I do think that even if I would hope that people that are human attention span is so small, it's possible someone could be like, I'm not interested in wilderness and not listen to this podcast. I would hope if they did, they would be drawn in and be like, I should be. I should at least have an understanding of this, because we're going to see how much this idea is tied into American identity. Really. With the frontier thesis, Frederick Jackson Turner, you're going to hear about it. But this is a good place to start. Luke, thanks for coming down, man.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me. Seriously, I really appreciate it. It's pretty wild. I never thought I'd ever be here doing this, truly. So I'm truly grateful that you guys allowed me to come down here and do this. It's been a pleasure.
If you come back, bring more crab.
Will do.
Yeah. Or don't come.
Yeah, right. We have the technology. We can make it happen.
Yeah, we know how to get through.
That's right.
Now.
We know now. I have a little watch list now.
This could be.
Or just have them drop shipped here when you come.
Yeah. Be a little parachute.
Oh, that's no fun. Yeah. No, if one day, my dream is that one day every TSA board in America will have a picture of a blue crab.
Yeah.
In a big circle with an X across it. And I'll be like, Luke McFadden did that.
It'll be my mark on society.
Yeah. No live blue crabs on the plane. All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. Simply pour a can in your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit SeafoamWorks.com to learn more.
Market House has the cleanest, leanest, juiciest meat and seafood shipped to your home overnight. Expect the service of a local butcher and the convenience of a large supplier. Unlike many online butchers, you can grab just one meal's worth or lock in for a subscription box. Choose from grass-fed and grass-finished beef, American Wagyu, free-range poultry, grass-fed lamb, wild-caught king crab, seafood, and more.
For 15% off your first order, use code COUNTRY at checkout. Just visit markethouse.com.
That's MARKETHOUSE.com. And use the code COUNTRY.